You know, I came from a non-Christian home and left home following Dad's footsteps. He was a fighter pilot in the Air Force, and that's what I wanted to do. And so came to the academy, and I guess it was the second semester. It was my first year, anyway. I had a roommate who was he had been a backslidden Episcopalian and gone to a Christian college, nearly drank himself to death. And serious, Ed Powell. And Ed decided his life was going the wrong direction, and so he said, "Man, I need some outside influence." So he joined the military to get some discipline in his life, and he needed some inside change. So he gave his heart back to the Lord, met the Navigators, and of course the Navs began to talk to him about fulfilling the Great Commission, you know, making disciples, and challenged him to start right where he was. And I was the person who was right where he was. I was his roommate. And so he began to pray for me, and one night Friday, of course, when you get your room ready for inspection, and we were sitting there waiting for the buffer to come down the hall because we put wax on the floor and we're going to buff it up. Nothing to do. And so there's nothing very clever about what he did. He just asked me, "Hey, do you ever think about God? Have you heard about Jesus? Ever read the Bible?" That kind of thing. What he didn't know is I'd been thinking about that for years. But I'd never had anybody my own age who was willing to talk about those things. And so I was just fascinated with this. And so, you know, he began to talk about, you know, he began to draw the bridge illustration, you know, with God on one side and man on the other. I mean, by the time he finished with that, it looked like the wiring diagram for a radio or something. You know, it had all these lines. And he asked me that night, he said, "Would you like to... Hey, you can start right now. I mean, God will come into your life. He'll change. You know, the Spirit of God will come in and begin to change you. And you can begin to know God tonight." Well, I was fat. I wanted to do that. But he said, "So would you like to do that?" And I said, "No." And the reason I said no wasn't because, you know, I didn't want to connect with God. The reason I said no is I knew that was going to change the rest of my life. I knew enough about God that you can't pretend, and that this was going to be a change point that would affect the rest of my life in a lot of ways. And so I wanted some time to think about it. Well, about, I guess it was about 3 or 4 weeks later, they had what they call an Andrew dinner. And Andrew, you know, is the one who went and got Peter and brought him to the Lord. So this is where the Christian guys brought their pagan friends. And and they had a pizza dinner somewhere in the upstairs, an old pizza house in Colorado Springs. And he invited me to go. Well, of course, you know, you're kind of trapped at the academy, so anything to get out. And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to go." And that night, Jerry White, who later became the, you know, director of the Navs, shared the gospel. Same bridge illustration. Car dealer shared how Christ had changed his life. And the pieces came together that night. And I remember going off in the corner after it was all over and bowed my head and heart and said, "Lord, if you love me this much to die for me." And I got it. You know, the pieces really came together. I realized, you know, the cross, he was dying for me. This is an expression of amazing love, you know, and I realized God loved me and what God offered was a wonderful thing. And I just said, "God, this is so good. This is so exciting." And I can remember praying just that night that God would give me, I remember the word tenacity, that I'd be able to follow through and I wouldn't drop out or fall back. But I wanted to follow God the rest of my life. Gave my life to Christ there. And of course that was just the beginning. It was interesting, we went back to the dorm and, in good Navigator style, Ed didn't really know how to ask me, "Now, what did you think of this? Did anything happen?" So what they did is they arranged this prayer meeting and they brought me into this prayer meeting. And the whole idea was we're going to pray around the circle and they wanted to hear what I said when it was my turn. That was it. I mean, that was their plan to find out had anything happened. Well, so, you know, a couple guys prayed and it came to me and I said, "God, I'm so grateful and I give you my life and my heart and this is such a wonderful..." Well, that was the end of the prayer meeting. Now it turned into a follow-up meeting. And I think this is true. He made me memorize my first verse before I went to bed that night. We had taps and you had to turn the lights out at midnight. And, so we're in these bunk beds and, you know, it was my spiritual birth certificate. And he said, you know, you'll need this because the devil's going to come. You have an enemy. You not only have a father and a savior and a spirit is inside, you've got a deadly enemy. And he's going to come and he is going to try to make you feel so silly for giving your life to Christ. And so I memorized 1 John 5:11-12. And this is the record that God hath given to us eternal life. And this life is in his Son. He that hath the Son hath life. And he that hath not the Son of God hath not life. 1 John 5:11-12. He said, now you remember that, because the enemy is going to come to you. I can remember the very spot I was on the terrazzo, the big concrete plaza there that we all formed up, marched off to Mia's. I can remember the very spot I was where the thought came, eternal life. That is the dumbest thing you've ever heard. Nobody lives forever. This is so stupid. And that verse came to mind. And this is a record that God hath given to us eternal life. And this life is in his Son. He that hath the Son hath life, and he that hath not the Son of God hath not life. And anyway, what I didn't realize is he had about 100 of those things. You know, I thought it was just one or two, and then you were done with this. Took me the rest of my 3 years there to get through the rest of those verses. I remember sitting up in Falcon Stadium as we were graduating, and he made me go through all of them before we left. And so anyway, so I'm a navigator. I don't know where you are in this, but first 10 years of my Christian life, this was my family right here. Just this kind of a place. Doing what you guys do, learning to meet with God day by day, learning to hide his word in the heart so that we can do life, learning to be companions with each other and really share life openly and transparently and carry each other and confess sin and pray for each other so that we're not alone. Learning to share your faith with the people around you. You cannot grow up, and I'm so grateful for my roots because there is no healthier way. I'm pastoring a church now. You know what we're doing in the church? They asked me to come in and say, hey, we want you to help us make disciples. And so we're doing three things. For the last 2 years, our goal has been three goals. One is to get everybody in the church having a quiet time. Just 15 minutes with God each day. Does that sound familiar? It's to get every man, every woman in a little small group of men or women where they push each other to connect with God, share their lives openly, how their marriage is going, how their work is going, how their thought life is going, so that they're companioned up. So that's the up, in, and then out. And we're trying to get teach everybody how to share Christ with the people around them. I mean, that's all we're doing. But it's the same stuff I learned 40 years ago in a living room just like this. So you are getting the most nutritionally rich ball of roots that you can get in just a fellowship like this. So anyway, we feel right at home. My wife Bev is, she was on Campus Crusade staff. I did what every good navigator guy did back in the 60s. I went to Campus Crusade to get a wife because, we weren't allowed to date in the navigator, so we had to kind of sneak off. And Crusade had a much healthier view of, romance than the navigators did in the 60s. So I snuck across the fence, married outside the faith, and grabbed a Campus Crusade gal. But Bev was in the military ministry with Crusade. She spent 4 years on their staff, and this was her life, was Bible studies with women in the military and couples and that kind of thing. So anyway, we're right at home. I want to talk to you tonight. Jack asked me what I was going to talk on. I said, well, I want to talk on the most important subject in the world. I mean, what else? So let me ask you, what's the most important thing for you to understand? For a human being, what is the most important thing for you to know, to realize in the core of your being and to understand? What do you think? Just think. I mean, don't you think this is important? To know what the most important thing to get your head and heart around would be?
God's love for us.
That's it. It's the love of God for us. Well, and you see why. The most important thing for you is to do what? Yeah, it's to love God with all your heart, right? That's the measure of your life. When you get to the end, it's not how much money you have. It's not how much control you have over people, right? It's not what people think about you, as you were saying in your testimony. It's your love for God, isn't it? But as you know, before we can love God, something else has to happen, right? There's a prerequisite for that. And that's that we've got to understand how much He loves us. Right? And so the most important subject in the world is the love of God for you. God's love for you. And it really is, you know, that changes, even for, and I'm talking about for folks like us, it changes our life with God radically. Because until we understand, and I mean, and I should say realize, I'm going to use the word realize, because we can understand it up here. But until we realize it in here, we are kind of afraid of God. I mean, that's the way we tend to be. We're afraid of the will of God. We almost don't want to hear for fear He's going to take our life and ruin it. Have you ever had that feeling? Yeah. You know, I'm not really sure I want to get a day away with God. Not really sure I want to hear what God has to say. Have you ever had that feeling? I don't know that I want to know what God really wants for me. Because the devil's lie, this is one of Leroy's, devil's lie, is that you cannot trust God, right? From the Garden of Eden. Hath God said you cannot eat of any of the trees in the garden? I can't believe He'd be that withholding, that stingy, that suppressive. I mean, that is the enemy's strategy from the first day he appears in the garden. It's to cast doubt and suspicion on the heart of God, so that you won't feel safe giving your life to Him. So that you won't know the good things that He has for you. So that you'll do what? You'll hide from Him. Until we understand the love of God, there's a sense, you know, we hear things like this, there's a sense, oh man, I know I've got to deal with God. He's almost an unfortunate, regrettable reality that I have to deal with. And I'm afraid of Him. And I'm afraid to hear from Him. And I'm afraid of what He'll do with me if I really trust Him and put my life in His hands. I mean, it's the way we are. It's the way we are with everybody. We're not going to give ourselves to somebody unless we trust that they'll take good care of us. And so the most freeing influence in your life is that if somehow by the grace and mercy of God, through the power of the Holy Spirit, He would reveal to your inmost being how much He loves you. Because that what that'll do is it releases you to give yourself, to not hide from Him, to not kind of keep Him at arm's length, to not work a life strategy where, and you know, this is really common. Where guys, it's almost like I really don't want to hear the love of God until I finish doing everything I really want to do. And then when I've finished, you know, I've married, I've had my children, I've had my fun, I've done what I want. The best way to deal with God is to kind of keep Him at arm's length until right before you die. And then somewhere right before you die, kind of really give yourself to Him. That way you get the best life here, which is my plan, and I get all of heaven later, right? I mean, people think like that. And that's the way we'll think until we understand how near and real and good God really is. And that changes everything. Once we understand the love of God, we want to give ourselves, we want to hear His voice. I mean, this is what releases us to worship from the heart. To listen to His Word without the fear that I'm going to run across some passage that's going to make me do something I really don't want to do. This is what makes me love God. This is what makes me want to talk about Him. You know, we will witness out of some peer pressure, out of some sense of responsibility. We'll do a little bit of that. But what makes a person an irrepressible witness is understanding the goodness of God. Paul said, the love of Christ compels us. This is what drives us. This is what makes me who I am. And he's not talking about his love for Christ. He's talking about it is the love of Christ for me. Because we thus judge that if one died for all, then we're all dead. And that he died for all that they which live should not henceforth live unto themselves, but unto him who died for them and rose again. This is what drives me. This is, if you look at the letters of Paul, in most of the letters, the first half is all about God's love for us. Look at Ephesians. Look at Romans. It's the first 11 chapters of Romans is all about the kindness, the mercy, the forgiveness, the goodness of God. And then in chapter 12, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, on the basis of God's love for you, having seen the goodness of God for you, that you give your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service. So it is, it's the most important subject in the world, is the kindness and love of God and for us. Now, here's what I want to do. I want to take you to the passage where God, the first place in the Bible where he describes his love. I want you to listen to God talk to you about his heart for you. And it's in Exodus 34. You remember the story, Moses going up on the mountain and he asked God to show, he says, show me your glory. And of course God said, this is in Exodus 34, and God says, I can't let you see my face. If you see my face, you'll die. But he says, I will make known my name. And in Hebrew, in Israel, the name, a person's name is their character. It's who they are. And so this is the first place in the scriptures where God kind of runs his heart through a prism and breaks it out into its component colors and describes his love. And here's what I want you to do. I want you to notice the first two words that God uses. It's like God is saying, if you don't understand anything else about me, I want you to remember these two things. Remember, this is the God of the Old Testament. You usually think of the God of the Old Testament as kind of stern and harsh, and nothing's further from the truth. It's the same God as in the Old, the same God you see in the face of Jesus, right? You see it here. Exodus 34, and I'll start with verse 4. He says, so Moses chiseled out two stone tablets like the first ones, went up to Mount Sinai early in the morning as the Lord had commanded him, and he carried the two stone tablets in his hands, and then the Lord came down in a cloud and stood there with him and proclaimed his name. In other words, I'm going to reveal who I am. This is his name. He's the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses proclaiming. Now watch how God describes himself. The Lord, the compassionate and gracious God. Slow to anger. Abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sins of the fathers to the third and fourth generation. This is a passage worth memorizing. What's the first thing God tells us about himself? If there's one thing I want you to know about me, it's that I am what?
Compassionate.
Compassionate. Isn't that amazing? That is the first thing God wants us to know. Not that he's big, not that he's powerful, not that he's wise, not that he's in charge. The first thing he wants a human being to know about him is he's compassionate. The Hebrew word for that is rachum. You got to spit to say it. Rachum. And the root of it, Jewish words, Hebrew words are very concrete. They're very visual. The root of this is womb. It's a woman's womb. And the feeling that it's designed, this word is designed to kind of evoke, is the love of a mother for a newborn child. You feel the tenderness of, you know, watching a mother hold, nurse. More general, it means the love of a parent for a child. Good parent for a child. I love you like a good father loves his son. Love you like a mother loves a newborn baby. Now think of that. It's the picture. There's patience there, there's mercy there, there's forgiveness there, there's constant attention, there's constant listening, there's longing, there's dreaming. I mean, it's a rich word. I love you like a parent loves a child. I lived a long time without understanding this as a believer. Now, I knew it. We all know this in our head. But there's a ministry of the Spirit that moves it from head to heart. And I want to tell you how that happened for me. After about, I think I'd been in ministry about 25, 30 years, I burned out. I just flat wore out. And a lot of it wasn't because people had unrealistic expectations of me. It's that I had a disease. And my disease, it has a very respectable sounding label over it, but it is dark. And my disease was perfectionism. And let me tell you what it is at the core. It's the need to be thought wonderful all the time by everyone. Some of it comes out of the fear that if I'm not wonderful, people will think poorly and reject me. That evokes some sympathy, I'm sure, from your heart. But I'll tell you what the core of it is. The core of it is somewhere in your life you taste, and it's like cocaine. You taste people telling you you're wonderful because how well you do. And you get addicted to that. You know, maybe you taste it in academics or something, and you score well, and somebody says, man, I can't believe that you can do all this stuff. And you do it all so well. And you get a prize, and everybody applauds, and everybody tells you how proud they are of you. And that gets in your bloodstream. You say, I got to have more of that. Or you're a woman, they tell you how attractive you are. And you say, I've got to have more of that. And what it did in my life is somewhere in there I tasted some success, and I saw my parents get proud of me, and I saw people gasp in awe and wonder at, how well I did, and people say, man, I just can't believe, who you are, and I could feel kind of this aura of admiration and so forth, and it was like a drug. And so I can remember, I would overachieve, drive myself to always be at the top. Jack mentioned I finished at the top of my class. I am not proud of that, because I finished at the top of my class, but at a horrendous price. There were times when I knew God wanted me to do other things, but boy, I would not leave the library until I knew I could outscore everybody on the exam. There was a drivenness to life. And yes, I performed well and I achieved well, and people kept, handing me plaques and trophies and gasping in awe and wonder, and I kept getting more and more addicted to that. And there was a drivenness to that. And it began to squeeze out. It squeezed out friendships. I didn't have time for friends. I was too busy being amazing. I didn't have time for God. I was too busy, being amazing. And so I was. I was amazing, and I was driven, and I was dying, and I was more and more isolated from God and from people. When I left the military and I started, pastoring churches, now how this would come out is, every Sunday you got to get up and give a message. And people say, oh, Pastor, that's a wonderful message. And I get addicted to that. And so I become driven. I mean, I just work. I'd prepare. I'd always be thinking about it, always making it better, always working. Well, I did that for about 20 years, and I just wore out. And nobody was being mean. I was doing this to myself. And so finally, my engine quit. And I tell people, my engine quit, and I crash-landed at Focus on the Family, and I went out there. And that's what I did. But I left the pastorate, because I was just burned out. And I remember getting into Colorado Springs and realizing I am not in good shape at all. There is a drivenness, there's an addiction that drives. My family would see this happening to me, always working in my head, always preoccupied with things, always trying to achieve, always trying to do better. And it was taking its toll. Somewhere in the early months out at Focus, I heard about a group. It was actually run by the NAVS, the NAV Counseling Department, about healing inner wounds. Fixing stuff that's broken inside that's making you crazy. And I said, I need that. And so I remember going. And it was real simple. I mean, basically what they said is, you know, often we do these kinds of things because there are lies we've made, there's vows we've made, there are things that have happened, and so it just keeps us in a cage. And I said, oh, I feel like I'm in a cage. And so I remember going, and the assignment was for an afternoon is to go out and get alone with God and ask the Lord, really ask the Spirit of God to reveal what's broken and where it all started. Well, I thought this isn't going to work. I was pretty Western. You know, Western means you don't really believe in supernatural things very much. And so I remember going out, it was raining, I was sitting in my car, and I said, God, this drivenness to always be amazing, to be perfect, that I know you don't want me to live like that. And I said, now would you show me, where did that begin? Where did that start? And I thought, nothing's going to happen here. But almost immediately, three pictures came to mind. Picture number one, I'm learning my multiplication tables. So I'm maybe 6, 7 years old. And I'm sitting at the dining room table, and Dad is my tutor. And we had a deal. You know, you'd memorize the sevens or the eights or whatever it is. And we'd always have a test. It was always the same time. It was Sunday night, right before Disneyland came on. And the deal was always the same. If I got them all right, I was a wonderful boy. But if I missed one, I was off television. Picture number two, I'm learning to tell time. This is what came to mind, a big picture of a clock, and that's what happened. We had this toy clock. Again, Dad is my tutor. He'd put the hands at different positions, and he'd turn it and say, what time is it? And the deal was always the same. It was Sunday night, right before Disneyland. If I got them all right, I was a wonderful boy. If I missed one, I was off TV. Picture number three. We're living, I would have been about 5 or 6 this time. We lived in Washington, D.C. We had these roses that grew along the split rail fence. And this is a picture that comes to mind. Dad hands me a mason jar full of kerosene. And he says, I want you to get the Japanese beetles off the roses. And these are these little bugs that get on roses in Virginia. And he said, when I come out, there better not be one Japanese beetle out here. Those are the three pictures that came to mind. Now, I want to say, Dad, you know, Dad was in no way trying to harm, scar, mar me. He's just trying to make a man out of me. He's trying to get me to be responsible and do it right the first time. I mean, there was no malice here. He's just trying to grow me up. But those are the three pictures. I said, now, Lord, okay. And those all happened. And I remember saying, so, Lord, what's the lie that I would have believed in all this? I mean, what got into my head at this point? And I sat there, and again, I thought, you know, this is silly. Nothing's going to come to mind. But almost immediately, first thing that came to mind is if a job isn't done perfectly, it's of no use whatsoever. It's worthless. Might as well not do it. And I really believe that. I mean, I did believe that. I can remember working on messages, getting ready to talk, to preach, and thinking, now if I don't get use just the right words and get just the right illustrations and tell just the right stories, and I don't get it exactly right, nothing will happen here. And we all know that's not true. We all know, you know, if you listen to a message, often it's some little fragment that almost has nothing to do with the main point. But God will take that, and it gets in there like a burr in a wonderful way, and I'll use it. You know, but I didn't believe that. I honestly believe if it wasn't perfect, it was no good. It wouldn't do any good. And I sat there a little bit longer, and a second thing came to mind. And that is, if a job isn't done perfectly, you are no good at all. I thought about that, and I said, you know, I believe that. Because if anybody ever came to me, say, after I'm speaking or preaching and said, oh, you know, maybe I told a story about cats, and they said, well, you know, I love cats, and you offended me by mentioning cats in a negative light, and you shouldn't have done that. Yeah, or anything like that. Suggested that any piece of it was wrong, inappropriate, misleading. My initial response was I'd always look down, I'd feel very ashamed of myself and say, I can't believe that I did it like that, that I didn't foresee it, I didn't fix it, I didn't get it right. You'd always be embarrassed and ashamed. And I never tell them, what I should have told them is, look, stick it in your ear, you know. I mean, really, give me a break. You know, lighten up. I mean, that's really what you should say in a case like that. But the point is, you know, there was this real shame and embarrassment about anything that wasn't done perfectly. And then this is where we come back to this passage on compassion. I said, God, if that's not true, if it's not true that if I don't do it perfectly, I am no good at all. You know, I'm irresponsible, I'm unreliable, I'm all those things that kind of crumb. What is true? And I just sat there, rain was falling, sitting in the car. And almost immediately, another picture came to mind. And this is a picture. It was something that had happened maybe 3 months before. We were visiting my daughter, Bethany. And Bethany, at that time, had about our grandson, Jack, was about 13 months old. And this is a picture that came to mind. It was a picture of me. I was sitting in a chair like this. And Jack, my grandson, was at a coffee table like this. He was just getting to the point, you know, where kids get where they're just beginning, almost can walk. And he was sitting there with his hands on this thing, and he was bouncing like this. And he was scooching his way around it. You know how little kids scooch away? And this is the picture that came to mind as I was sitting in the car. The picture was me with my hands out saying, Jack, Jack, come on over here. Now, as I thought about that, I knew exactly what God was saying. He's saying, I feel about you the way you feel about Jack. Now, I knew how I felt about Jack. I'd put my hands out like this. I said, Jack, Jack, come on over here. And I knew what would happen. Jack would kind of laugh, and he'd kind of shake over there. And I said, Jack, come on over here. And I knew what would happen. He'd let go. He'd take about one step, maybe a step and a half, and he'd fall on his butt. And then what I would do is I'd scoop Jack up, and I'd say, Jack, I am so proud of you. That was so good. See, all I wanted Jack to do is to try. And if he tried, I was so proud of him. And I'd put Jack back over there, and I'd say, Jack, let's try it again. Come on over here. And Jack, he'd clench up his muscles, and he'd look over here, and he'd take one, you know how they take a monster step, you know, kind of like this, and go like that, and go like that. And he'd fall on his butt again, and I'd pick him up. And I'd say, Jack, I'm so proud of you. Now, here's the deal. Can you understand what God is saying? He was saying to the core of my being, I feel about you the way you feel about Jack. I look into your heart. I see your heart. When I see you longing and trying, you know, to walk with me, and you fall on your butt, whether it's in thought life, whether it's with the words that you use, whether it's preaching a sermon, whether it's trying to lead somebody to Christ and it doesn't go the way you think it ought, you just need to know, I am so proud of you that you would just try. What is that? Well, it's this. Compassion. Psalm 103, it says, as a father has compassion on his children, so the Lord has compassion on those that fear him. Now, I can't tell you what a liberating thing that was for me. And I realize people may like it or not like it, but you know, God is pleased even when things aren't perfect. That's compassion. Now, I just want to say that, you know, and I'll tell you why this is so important. You know what the number one killer among Christians is? Things that causes people to walk away from God and just give up. You know, it's not immorality, it's not greed, it's not arrogance, it's not all that stuff. It's a broken heart. It's just discouragement that I can't do it perfectly. And so there's no use trying. I can't be a Christian. I can't do it. I can't keep my thoughts right. I can't keep it all together. I can't keep my faith as strong as it needs to be. I can't be as courageous as I need to be. I can't be as disciplined as I need to be. I can't, you know, we see the imperfections and we know them in our heart of hearts, things that nobody else knows. And often at some point we just get exhausted and tired of trying to be perfect. And we need to know desperately that God doesn't expect us to be, you know, perfect. He loves us like I love Jack. That's compassion. There's forgiveness. There's patience. There's kindness. There's a Father's love for you. Now, there's a second thing here. Ah, we're out of time, aren't we? But
It's okay.
I want to tell you about one other dimension of the love of God. But does this make sense? Can you feel that? I mean, you know, God is a lot friendlier than we understand. Some of us were raised in homes where when your dad came home, you went to hide because you were kind of afraid to bother him. You know, I mean, really, that was your picture of dad. If there was something you needed in your heart, you didn't want to bother dad because he was always busy, he was tired, he was on the edge. Some of us grew up with dads like that, and if that's the way your dad is, that's often the way we see God, as somebody who's, boy, I don't want to bother him. I know he's upset. Others of us may have had the privilege of when dad came home, man, you wanted to run out and jump in his lap. When it was Saturday morning, you wanted to get up and go jump on the bed because you just knew dad had a wonderful day planned. God is like that second father. And when we understand that, we quit being afraid of him. You know, we quit, yeah, does that make sense? We quit kind of trying to avoid him. We quit straining to be good enough so maybe he'll like me. And we realize he is the safest, warmest, friendliest creature. He's not a creature, person in all the universe. I mean, and that is when life with God, rather than becoming a heavy pack, becomes a real privilege and a joy. Okay. I'll tell you one more story. The second word is, what is it? What's the second thing God wants us to know about him? Gracious. Now, that's one of those religious words that we use all the time and nobody has a clue what it means, right? Nothing comes to mind. I mean, gracious. What is it? You know what it means? It means generous. It means he gives you way more than you'd expect. Far more than you'd expect. It means you walk with him, you wind up at the end of your life saying, I can't believe what God has done. It's far more. That's what gracious means. Generous. Generous with his forgiveness, generous with his kindness, generous with his goodness, generous with the way he changes and what he does. I mean, that's what the word means. It means he's generous. He gives way more than we'd ever imagine. Right now, unto him who's able to do exceeding abundantly beyond all that we ask or think. I'm come that you might have life and have it abundantly. It overflows. David said, my cup does what? Runneth over. Right? These are the words that people who walk with God and look back wind up, it's the way they describe their life at the end. Doesn't mean it's always easy. It's not. You go back and there's heartaches and there's gut-wrenching times of difficulty and hardship and at times suffering. That's all part of the goodness of God. He's trying to grow us up. He's trying to transform us from little devils to little Jesuses. And that often takes, you know, it takes hard times. That's the way he allows us to be heroic. That's the way he's going to be able to say, well done. He's not going to say that just, you know, meaningless. He's going to say, well done. I mean, you done well. You didn't quit when everybody else, you persevered. I mean, his well done is meaningful because it will mean we done well. I mean, so there's hardship in it. But you look back and there's a generosity. There is no richer way to end your life than having followed God with all your heart. Now, that's something the Spirit of God has to reveal. Let me tell you how this happened with me. Do you want to do that? You have about 15 more minutes? Okay. You okay? When I graduated from the academy, I was engaged. And I was engaged to the wrong girl, and I knew it. I knew it when I asked her to marry me. This was not the one, but we'd gone together for 7 years, and it's what you do. And the reason it wasn't the right one is, here's the reason. The reason, she's a wonderful gal. But, you know, in that time, that's where I gave my life to Christ, and I shared this with this gal, and she thought it was wonderful for me, but she never got her heart around it. And I didn't know a lot as a young Christian, but I knew if you want to live for God, you've got to get a companion who has the same soul. So that you're not just carrying her, but when you need carrying, she's going to carry you. She's not going to let you quit. And I knew that. And I knew that that wasn't the case with this gal. But, you know, as you do with when you're young, I mean, insecurity and the fun of having a girlfriend and all that stuff, I mean, I knew in my soul this was not the right person. But I didn't want to let go. So I graduated from the academy, went to Purdue, became part of the NAV team there, so on leadership. But I didn't tell him I was engaged. Now that's a big thing, don't you think? I mean, you know, I mean, it was months before my leader, somebody like Jack. I mean, can you imagine having a guy in the middle of your leadership team and he's engaged, you don't know about it. Well, I didn't know it. I didn't want to tell. So anyway, but somehow this guy found out. Now he's gracious. He was as kind as he could be. He says, "Hey, I understand you're engaged. That's a wonderful thing. Big step in your life. What a happy thing. Tell me about it." Well, I didn't want to tell him about it. I didn't want to tell anybody about it. So I told him about it and painted it as brightly as I could, but he sensed something wasn't right. So here's what he did. He said, "Look," he said, this is a big decision. This is going to, more than anything else, who you marry is going to determine the color of the rest of your life. You marry well, life is good. You marry poorly, life is very painful." So he said, what you need to do is, here's what I'd like you to do. Would you just go out and spend just half a day with God and ask him one more time how he feels about this? And would you come back and tell me what he says? He wasn't being accusing. He was being very wise. So I remember going out on the banks of the Wabash River there right by the university. And I can remember getting out there, and you know, I'd throw stones in the river and I'd watch the squirrels and anything to not have to deal with God. Have you ever kind of been in that situation? I didn't want to get down to business because I didn't want to hear. And I can remember, you know, just, you know, like they tell you how to do in half a day with God, reading the scriptures. And I mean, and I can remember coming to about the end of the first hour, and what God did through that whole first hour is he took me to passage after passage that talks about how much he loved me. He's just talking to me about the love of God for me. He wanted to take the fear out of my heart. And there are two passages I can't. One was Psalm 37:4. "Delight thyself also in the Lord, and he shall give thee the desires of thine heart." The last passage that really turned on the light, Psalm 84:11, it says, "The Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory, and no good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly." And the Spirit of God, you know, I remember sitting there and I remember thinking, you know, I don't want to spend the rest of my life wondering what God would have done if I had trusted him. And I knew what the Lord wanted. So I folded up my books, I went back, you know, and the guy is John Sackett. John was back. He was a missionary in the Philippines and Netherlands. John said, "Hey, tell me about what the Lord said." And I said, "John, I've got to end it. It's not right." He prayed for me, put me in my car, drove down across Indiana to the University of Tennessee where she was going to school, got my ring back. Both of our hearts were broken. It was about... Gosh, it was just, I think it was maybe 6 months later. I remember flying home. And before I was flying home, I talked on the phone to my mom and she said, "Rock, we've got this gal has moved in with us. Name's Beverly. Works with Campus Crusade. She needed a place to stay. And we got an extra bedroom." And she said, "I think you'll enjoy meeting Beverly." And I wasn't interested. My heart was still broken. So anyway, Bev, you want to come up and tell what happened? You got to hear this story. This is the world's second greatest love story. The first greatest is yours, but this is the second greatest right here. So I want you to tell the story from where we met.
I still cry when I tell it, so forgive my tears, but and I pray that after 36 years you'll still cry about how God brought you to your husband or your wife. Well, I moved in and heard that that their big brother was had just graduated from pilot training, was going to go on vacation, so he had to go through Norton to I was a new Christian. I'd really only committed my life to the Lord about a year and a half. So with Campus Crusade, you only have to be a Christian a year to go on staff. So, I mean, I'm really young. But I hear Rock's coming home, and I come from a very broken, alcoholic, non-Christian family. So I had seen how Rock had led his whole family to Christ, and I thought, oh man, I can't wait to meet this guy. And so we get the call. He's at the airport. The parents are gone. I'm the only one with the car, and we're running around. Rock's here. Rock's here. And can't find my keys. And I stop and think, why am I so excited? You know. So we go to the airport, and really, I had completely stopped dating after becoming a Christian. I mean, for me, that's just what I needed to do. And having a ministry, guys were just not a part, the focus. But Rock's standing out in his uniform. He gets in, and I can just remember driving home going, oh my goodness, you know, he's so cute. And I mean, there's nothing cuter than a guy in a uniform or a flight suit. I mean, I love flight suits. Well, a godly guy in a flight suit. So anyhow, that night we just sat in their family room and both shared how we had given our life to Christ, and that the most important thing was knowing Him and helping other people know Him. And it was just a really fun evening of getting acquainted. But I can remember as I went up to my room, a strange thing happened. I found myself on my knees before the Lord, and I just said, Lord, I don't know what you have planned, but I know what I hope you have planned. I mean, I had this strange just desire. And I know that happens to girls, and it's not the right one. Well, and I wish I could say Rock was on his knees, too, going, you know, this is the one. Well, he was not on his knees. In fact, it was 3 years from that point that Rock showed any interest at all in me. And in fact, he kind of avoided me, you know. It was, and then he'd come home to visit, and I would be so nervous. I couldn't talk. I couldn't eat. I mean, have you ever been that way around a guy you kind of liked, you know? You just, well, that's how I was, at least. And so that was just a waiting time where really God was doing some things in both of us. You know, He'd just come out of this not good relationship, and I just needed to grow in the relationship that was most important, which was the Lord. And so after about 3 years, Campus Crusade wanted to move me from Southern California up to Monterey, you know, beautiful Northern California. Who would not want to go to the Defense Language Institute, you know? I mean, it was a great assignment, but I wanted to stay in smoggy San Bernardino because that was my link to the Bottomleys and to Rock. And I remember that summer as I was thinking through this new assignment, I just felt like God was saying, if I loved you enough to die for me, for you, you can trust me with Rock. You know, if I want to bring you two together, I can do that. And so it was one of those aha moments. I can't manipulate this. So I accepted my assignment, and I thought, boy, I need to, after staff training, to stop at the Bottomleys and let them know that I'd be leaving the area and leaving their families. Because in that 3 year period, I became a part of their family. So I stop in, and lo and behold, Colonel Bottomley was getting ready to retire, and they'd been looking for a couple years over Nevada, California, I mean, all over the western part of the U.S., looking for a horse ranch. And that same week that my assignment had been moved to Monterey, they bought a horse ranch 55 miles in the mountains of Santa Cruz. So, and also the Bottomleys, they were hoping their brother would wake up, you know. So when we realized that I was moving north, you know, I mean, we were dancing. We were going, you know, maybe something's going to happen. And So I moved to Monterey, and it was now Christmas time, and I said to my roommate, I said, "Do you want to hear my ultimate dream?" And she said, "Oh, what is that?" And I said, "Well, for Rock to come home to the ranch, not to go. He was thinking about going to a navigator conference, and for you know, to come home, and then for me to get to see him, and then for him to invite me to San Francisco, and then on top of Telegraph Hill, which is my favorite place in San Francisco, to ask me to marry him." And after I said that, I walked to my room, and I thought, that is the dumbest thing you have ever said. I mean, he hasn't even said, "I like you," let alone, "Will you marry me?" But I had just finished reading the story. It was called A Man Called Peter, and it was a story of Peter Marshall, a very famous pastor, and he later became the chaplain of the Senate. And there was a quote in it, in the book, that just went across the screen of my mind, and it said, "Anything is possible with a dream big enough and God's will behind it." And that was kind of it. I just put it down, and I went home to Bakersfield, and then the day after Christmas, I went to the Bottomley's ranch. And lo and behold, Rock was there, and I'd been there about a day. I was there with my little seventh grade sister, and he said, we were out in the family room, and he said, "Oh, would you like to get some time?" I think that was sort of a navigator. "Well, do you want to get some time? You want to get some time? You and your sister, would you and your sister like to go to San Francisco?" And so I said, "Oh, sure," you know, trying to be really, you know, cool. And so the next morning, I mean, I still have my quiet time notes where, again, I just said, "Lord, more than anything, I want that I want to marry Rock. But more than anything, you know, again, it's that lordship of, I want you." And, you know, so I have to, again, put, you know, Isaac on the altar. And I just said, "But Lord, just help us to have a good time," because he'd come home. And again, I couldn't talk. I'd have stomach problems. I couldn't eat, and I loved to eat, you know, so we did. My sister didn't go. I'm not quite sure how I managed that, but I mean, it's like, you're not going to San Francisco with us, you know. But anyhow, she stayed back. But we did. We just had a wonderful day, and then it was in the afternoon, and I can remember I couldn't stop smiling, and I was saying, "Lord, control my emotions, control my emotions." And then we got to Fisherman's Wharf, and I couldn't eat. And, "Lord, control my emotions, control my emotions." And then I said, "Oh, I haven't taken you to my favorite place, Telegraph Hill," which, you know, I'd go with the girls, you know. I mean, honestly, I don't remember this, but I would take the girls in our Bible study. We'd go to Telegraph Hill, and I said, I want to take you to Telegraph Hill. So we went up, and it was about 9:30, and it was December 28th. It was real misty. If you've ever been to San Francisco, on top of Telegraph Hill, it's the most beautiful place in the world. And we walked out on this little knoll, and we were looking out, and I looked over at Rock, and he had this real serious look in his eye. But even at 22, when he'd come home, he would gather the family, he would teach, you know, I mean, his teaching gift would come out, and he'd have that look in his eye. And so I honestly thought he was going to say something spiritual. So I kind of give him a little elbow, and I go, "Penny, for your thoughts." Well, the next thing I know, he is standing like right here. I mean, like right here. And he told our students at Focus for 7 years that I kissed him, but I did not kiss him. I don't think so, but I don't know. I mean, it could have, but anyhow, he's standing there, and he just said, "I can't be accused of moving too fast. Will you marry me?" He asked me to marry him. I know. I couldn't believe it. I knew it was. He was an astronautical. It took me years to even learn how to say it. An astronautical engineer, and it was the most impulsive thing. But God really led him, and I didn't have to pray about it. I'd been praying about it for 3 years, you know. So, it was, I mean, we knew that God brought us together. I mean, we drove home back, it was about 2 hours back to the ranch, and I think we kissed at every red light. I mean, God brought us together. And Anne, I, of course I said, yes, my goodness. No, I mean, it was the fullness of time. I was just so... I was so excited. You know, I do remember wanting to stop people as we were walking down the hill. But it wasn't until I got back to my assignment that I related the story to my roommate. And it was then that she said, Bev, don't you remember what you said to me? And then she just shared the story of Telegraph Hill. So it was one of the most personal ways that God has really shown his love to me, that's pretty extraordinary. But I think another reason God did that is I have never for a second questioned the fact that God brought us together. Because even though we knew God brought us together, there have been some areas in our marriage that have been very difficult to overcome. And yet, I know I have never once for a second ever considered divorce. Now, there have been times I've wanted to die because there have been some areas in me, some broken areas from my background sexually that really came out in marriage that we didn't know about. And so there really has been some areas that we've just had to cling to the fact, one, God brought us together. And as we've trusted him, as we've walked through it, as we've gotten help, now as we've moved through it, we are so, and I mean, we've had a good marriage. We have four wonderful kids that are walking with the Lord, but it was harder than, I mean, marriage has been really harder than we thought. And I think that's part of why we've had the opportunity to teach marriage, because I just thought you just asked to be filled with the Spirit. You have two of us being filled with the Spirit, and it's just, you know, you just get closer to each other and you get closer to the Lord. Well, that's true. But there's some shaping that goes on that is just harder. So I honestly think that's one reason God answered that prayer so unusually, but I'm sure glad he did.
All right. Isn't that a good love story? That's a good love story. All right. Okay, now let me see if I can connect some dots for you. First of all, she did kiss me, and I'll tell you how I know. When I was driving the top of Telegraph Hill, I was not thinking about asking Bev to marry me. That kind of happened. Well, the Spirit of the Lord came upon me there, and that's kind of what happened. But when she kissed me, three things came kind of converged, you know, in my astronautical engineer mind. She loves God, she doesn't eat much, and she kisses great. And I thought, what more could you want in a wife than that? That's it. That was it. And I realized, anyway, there's a more backstory to this. It's not as crazy as it sounds. I had my eye on Bev for a long time. And, anyway, that's another story. But here's the point. I mean, did you listen to, Bev had a dream, you know, that was impossible. I had no idea about the dream. I just wanted to get some time with Bev and take her sister and her to San Francisco. I mean, that's what it was. God worked in that thing. I mean, there was a light coming on in an unusual way. I do think there was a ministry of the Spirit going on there. And I mean, he brought all those things to pass. So that really the desire, delight thyself also in the Lord and he'll give you the desires of your heart. But the other one, remember that banks of the Wabash River? Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from them that walk uprightly. And I want you to know, the brightest spot in my life has been my marriage to Bev. And I go back to that crisis of decision, you know, where it felt like I was giving away everything precious. You can never outgive God. He is compassionate like a father. Jack, come on over here. I am so proud of you. And he's gracious, generous, beyond belief to those that walk uprightly. So I just want to encourage you, you know, as you do life, to tune in to the love of God, the kindness of God as he reveals it in his book, as he reveals it in the circumstances of your life. The more you see the love of God, the less afraid of him and of his will you'll be, the more excited you'll be about going for it with all your heart and doing whatever he leads you to do. Father, I just pray, you said, we know it's your spirit that reveals your love. And I pray for the men and women here. Lord, I'd pray like Paul that you would strengthen them with power through your spirit in the inner man so that Christ would dwell in their hearts by faith. And that they would come to know the breadth and length and depth and height and to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. That they might be filled up to all the fullness of God. Amen.